Okay, let's unpack this. We're about to jump into, well, a really fascinating and frankly pretty little known piece of history. German colonization in the Zamość region, that's Zamość-Dyzna, mainly happening back in the late 18th century. Now, why look at this? Because, you know, this isn't just some dusty historical footnote. It turns out this seemingly forgotten episode has a direct and actually quite dramatic link to what happened in that same region during World War II.
That's really the heart of our deep dive today. We're drawing on some specific source material, including a key document called Historia Niemieckiej Kolonizacji Zamożczyzny, plus other related stuff, to really get a handle on what went on.
Right.
Our goal here is to pull out the most important bits of information, figure out the why and the how of this colonization, and also look at the, you know, the human side through specific examples, and then understand this surprising twist, how this community, which was pretty much forgotten, had even lost its original language over time, suddenly reappeared in a really tragic way during the Nazi occupation.
Yeah, that's the part that really grabbed me, this idea of a community just living quietly for generations, kind of blending in, losing their ancestors' language, and then, bam, being rediscovered for this terrible purpose much, much later.
Exactly. It just shows how these historical threads can run incredibly deep, sometimes hidden, you know, only to surface again with huge, unexpected consequences.
So let's set the scene a bit. Where does this story really begin, geographically and politically?
Okay, it kicks off in 1772. Big upheaval. The second partition of Poland, the Zamożan region, Zamożczyzna, which was Polish, suddenly becomes part of the Austrian Empire. It gets folded into what they called Austrian Galicia.
And what was this new Austrian territory like back then? Developed? Populated?
The sources paint a picture of it being pretty underdeveloped, actually. The population was largely quite poor. Austrian officials looked at it and saw potential, definitely, but they thought it needed improvement, especially agriculture, infrastructure. Their idea was, well, let's bring in settlers, people who could maybe introduce better farming methods, new skills.
Right, so like an early kind of economic development strategy using immigration.
Pretty much, yeah. But the first steps were quite cautious. Empress Maria Theresa was in charge then, and she was, well, hesitant. She worried about how stable these newly grabbed Polish territories actually were. And a big worry for her was settling non-Catholics. She feared it might stir up trouble with the local Catholic and Greek Uniate populations. So her early rules only allowed Protestant merchants and craftsmen to settle, and only in a few specific cities. No farmers allowed, especially Protestant ones.
Okay, so a limited start, focused on skilled workers in towns. But then her son, Joseph II, takes the throne. And he was known for being much more of a reformer, right? More forward-thinking, perhaps.
Joseph II definitely changed the game. He had far fewer doubts about holding on to the new territories long-term, and he had a much more, let's say, positive view of Protestants. He saw them as potentially loyal subjects, valuable contributors. This shift in thinking really opened the door for colonization on a much bigger scale.
And that's what we call the Josephinian colonization.
Exactly that. It really kicked off with an imperial patent, a decree on September 17th, 1781. This was actually inspired, apparently, by methods Frederick the Great was using over in Prussia, and it launched large-scale, state-sponsored colonization that explicitly included agricultural settlers, not just the urban types. And crucially, just a couple months later, another patent, November 11, 1781, specifically said Protestants were welcome to settle right alongside Catholics.
So the doors swing wide open. What kind of numbers are we talking about here? Was it a huge influx?
For the time, yeah, it was pretty significant. The sources suggest around 14,400 settlers came in. That's over 3,200 families. And the main wave of this migration happened quite fast, mostly between 1783 and 1784.
Where were these people actually coming from? Specific parts of Germany?
Yes, mostly. The sources say over a third came from the Palatinate region, the Pfalz. Other big groups were from Swabia, Württemberg, Franconia, and areas along the Rhine and Mosel rivers. So, you know, distinct German regions with their own dialects and ways. And the Austrian admin, they were quite methodical about how they placed these different groups. They deliberately grouped settlers by religions, Lutherans with Lutherans, Calvinists with Calvinists, Catholics together. The thinking was to try and head off potential arguments over things like churches or cemeteries in these new communities.
Smart. What was the religious breakdown among them?
Protestants were actually the majority, about 60%. Lutherans were the biggest chunk of that, maybe 47%. Calvinists around 13%, and a tiny number of Mennonites, less than 1%. The Catholic settlers making up about 39%. They didn't usually build new churches. They just used the existing local Catholic parishes nearby.
Sounds like a massive logistical operation. Did the process evolve as they went along? Did they tweak the rules?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it did. The sheer number of people arriving and just the complexity of managing it all led to changes. By July 1782, they tightened up the official definition of who counted as a colonist. It became stricter, only non-Austrian citizens arriving after that 1781 patent. And they also started giving priority for state help to colonists who had more money.
Ah, okay. So not everyone got the same welcome package, so to speak.
Exactly. They basically created different categories. You had the privileged colonists. These were people who showed up with a decent amount of their own cash, anywhere from 200 to 1,000 golden.
And what was that worth back then?
Well, a few hundred golden could buy you a small house, maybe a couple of horses. So 1,000 was quite substantial for a farmer or craftsman. These privileged folks got better treatment. Prime locations, more land, bigger houses and buildings provided by the state, more livestock. They were settled on state land, cameral land, and their passports even marked them as privileged.
Right. And if you turned up without that kind of money?
Then you fell into the unprivileged category. You still got settled on state land, and the state covered the cost, but you didn't get the same level of resources or priority. Both these groups were part of the main government colonization program, but there was also a third group. People who came at their own risk off Eigenegefahr. They got permission, like a government passport, but no financial help from the state. These were often folks coming to join family who were already there. The government kind of treated them like free agents. They weren't tied to a specific state plot. They could move around looking for work.
Okay, so how did the Austrian government actually convince thousands of Germans to just pack up everything and move all the way to Galicia?
They actively went out and recruited them. The government used agents based in Vienna, and they sent special recruiters into the German territories, focusing on those regions we mentioned, the Palatinate, Swabia, etc. They put up posters, handed out copies of the colonization patents in towns and villages, really trying to sell the opportunity.
Was there any interest from, say, German speakers who had maybe left Polish lands earlier?
Yeah, that's interesting. The toleration patent, the one allowing Protestants, actually sparked interest among some Protestant families of German origin who had emigrated from Poland previously because of religious pressure. They saw this as a chance to come back under better, more tolerant conditions.
So once someone decided, okay, I'm going, what was the actual journey like? Must have been incredibly difficult.
Oh, absolutely. A massive undertaking. Settlers would basically sell off almost everything they own, just keep essentials. They'd gather at designated points, travel by wagon, often in groups, to ports on the Danube River, places like Donauwörth, Günzburg, Ulm. From there, they'd board riverboats, basically barges, for the long trip down the Danube all the way to Vienna.
So Vienna was like a big processing hub.
Exactly. They had a special agent there, Josef Antoni Welz, whose job was specifically to handle these immigrants. In Vienna, they'd trade in their original travel papers for new Austrian passports. These passports would actually spell out their specific route onward into Galicia. From Vienna, they'd be directed towards places like Biasza, or if they were coming from Prussian areas, maybe directly towards Zamoście, which acted as a key transit city.
Did the government help pay for this travel part?
Yes, they did provide some financial aid for the journey itself. The sources mention 2 groschen per person for every mile of the route specified on their passport.
Where did they actually stay, along the way, or when they first arrived before their farms or houses were raided?
Well, initially, they were often put up in local peasant farms. Sometimes the farmers weren't even paid for this at first, or they used buildings from monasteries that had been shut down. Things got pretty desperate at times. One source mentions that at one point, it got so crowded, they actually ordered Jewish residents in Zamoście out of their homes to make room for the incoming colonists. Yeah. Though apparently, compensation was paid later to those Jewish residents, provided they were up to date on their taxes. But you can imagine, with thousands of people on the move, crammed into temporary lodging, conditions were tough. Overcrowding definitely led to outbreaks of infectious diseases. The authorities tried to provide some medical care, setting up temporary hospitals, assigning doctors and midwives, but it was a constant struggle.
Sounds like a really rough start. So what happened when they finally got to the Zamoście district? What was the process?
Okay, so upon arrival, their travel passports were taken away. An official, a sort of curator for the colonists, would then register the head of each family. They'd fill out a booklet listing all the family members and itemizing all the costs the state had incurred for them, the travel money, food, lodging, any medical help. Interestingly, only the initial travel aid money was technically supposed to be repaid. The rest was essentially a grant to get them started.
And did they get their land straight away?
Ugh, that was a major problem. The whole process of surveying the land, dividing it into plots, and actually building the new houses, it was slow and expensive for the government. The sources suggest some colonists ended up waiting for up to 3 years in temporary housing before their permanent farm plots and homes were ready. Imagine that.
3 years. Wow.
Yeah. And the state administration really focused its efforts on the state-sponsored colonists, the Cameral ones. Those who came privately or at their own risk were largely left to fend for themselves once they arrived, unless they got sick.
You mentioned a specific passport example earlier. That sounded fascinating.
Yes, it's a great little detail from the source. It's the emigration passport for a guy named Franciszek Adam Dedich, a peasant from Sarpfalz. He traveled with his wife and two kids in 1785. And his passport literally maps out the whole journey. Leaves Sarpfalz, gets on a boat at Ulm, down the Danube to Vienna, then overland through Moravia, Silesia, to Biała, then Tarnów, Dybica, Szakut, Jarosław, and finally arriving in Zamość.
That's incredible detail, a real itinerary.
It is. And the passport for that last leg from Biała to Zamość even notes that his brother-in-law, Amarek Denner, was already settled somewhere in the Zamość district. So you see that chain migration happening, people following family or connections. And here's that echo again. The source confirms that descendants of this Dedich family, whose name evolved to Tetik, were living in the village of Sabaudia in 1941. Right there, that direct line across the centuries to the WWII period.
That family story really makes it concrete. Now, you mentioned private landowners getting involved too, not just the state.
Yes, Emperor Joseph II realized the state couldn't shoulder the whole burden. So around 1784, he started actively encouraging Polish private landowners to settle German families on their estates. And he offered a pretty hefty incentive, 250 to 300 gulden for every family they settled. Remember, 300 gulden was almost enough to build a new farmhouse. That was serious money.
And Count Andrzej Zamoyski, the big local landowner, he jumped on this.
He certainly did. Count Andrzej Zamoyski signed a formal agreement with the emperor in October 1784. He committed to settling 80 German peasant families on his lands, and he got that payment, 250 gulden per family.
So what kind of deal did Zamoyski offer these settlers? What were they promised?
It was actually quite attractive. The sources mention around 30, maybe 40 morgues of land. Morgue was a local measure for farming, plus about 10 morgues of meadowland. They were promised a house with a proper chimney, which was a big deal for many peasant families back then, plus building materials for stables and barns, although the settlers usually had to build those themselves. They also got grain for their first sowing season, access to common pastures for grazing, and crucially, credit for essentials. Livestock, typically two horses, two cows, a pig, and tools like plows, harrows, a wagon, household stuff. This credit was repayable, but usually only after 6 years. Plus, they got a 3-year exemption from paying rent.
Sounds pretty good. Were there any catches? Any strings attached?
Usually, yes, with these private contracts. Often they included clauses like banning the settlers from making or importing their own alcohol they had to buy from the landowner's brewery or tavern, or requiring them to use the landowner's mill for their grain. These were ways the landowner kept control and generated income. They also typically required a few days of corvée labor per year working on the landowner's fields. And often the whole colony was collectively responsible for paying the total rent and taxes. If one family defaulted, the others might have to cover it. Now, the sources don't explicitly say if Zamoyski's contract had the alcohol and milling restrictions, but the labor and collective responsibility parts were pretty standard.
Did Zamoyski provide for everything, like community needs?
Well, one interesting point noted is that Zamoyski's contract, unlike some other private settlement deals, did not specifically set aside land or provide materials for building a school for the colonists' children.
How did the emperor react to Zamoyski stepping up like this?
Oh, he was thrilled. Extremely pleased. He viewed it as a great example of a landowner doing his patriotic deed. He was so happy, he ordered Zamoyski's actions to be publicized through official government circulars as an example for others. The source even quotes one, praising Zamoyski for fulfilling the highest intentions with the complete satisfaction of the most serene lord. High praise indeed. It showed the state really wanted private help. And it wasn't just farmers. They even brought in 10 families of craftsmen in March 1785, apparently because the peasant settlers themselves requested them. shows some responsiveness to community needs.
So where exactly did Zamoyski settle these families? Which villages?
He settled them across quite a few of his villages. Places like Raniek, Korcho, Sitaniek, Huska, Horsau, Bjarbrigzi, Zamsh, Roboruno, Sabaudia, Brody, and Dobrosi. The sources suggest, though, that the settlers on Zamoyski's estates were probably Catholics. That might have been a specific requirement in his agreement with the emperor. And other landowners joined in, too, not just Zamoyski. Ludwik Bielski settled 16 families in Miosten, and Piotr Lubowicki settled 25 families in Szynietyc. He actually got the higher rate, 300 gulden per family. He gave them a good amount of land, too. But there's a bit of a dark side there. The sources mention Lubowicki later kicked out 5 of those German families in 1792 and replaced them with Polish peasants. So, you know, settlement wasn't always permanent or secure.
Did these communities that Zamoyski and others set up actually last? Did people stay?
For the most part, yes. Descendants of these original colonists were still living in many of these same villages right up until World War II. There were a few exceptions early on. Places like Zank, Rojaniec, and Korcho were apparently abandoned by the German settlers relatively quickly. The soil quality was supposedly quite poor there, but even those places had an initial recorded German population.
How were they physically arranged? Were they separate German villages or mixed in?
It varied. There were a few different patterns. Sometimes colonists were settled right within existing Polish villages, like in Dobrosi or Brody, so more integration from the start. Other times they settled near an existing village but formed a distinct German community, creating these colonies attached to the old village name, like Kolonia Sitaniek, next to the Polish village of Sitaniek. And then you had completely new villages founded from scratch, specifically for the German colonists, often on former state land. Sabaudia is a key example of that, a compact new German settlement.
Interesting to think about the mark they left on the landscape. I guess maps from that time would show these new places popping up.
Absolutely. The detailed Austrian military maps of Galicia and Lodomeria, surveyed around 1779-1783, already show places like Rojaniec, Korcho, Huska, and Sitaniek reflecting the presence of these new German communities.
We focused a lot on the rural settlements, but what about Zamosis town itself? Were German colonists encouraged to settle there too?
Yes, definitely. There was actually an earlier patent from back in 1774 aimed specifically at urban settlers, merchants, craftsmen. That patent allowed Catholics to settle in any town in Galicia. But for Protestants, it was much more restricted. They could only settle in 4 specific towns: Low, Jarosław, Zamosis, and Zalaczyki.
Now, what kind of rights did Protestants get if they settled in Zamosis under that 1774 rule?
They were guaranteed freedom of religion, the right to build their own churches called Zimbori, the right to own homes, and they got a 6-year break from certain local taxes and dues. And indeed, a group of 28 Protestant craftsmen families did settle in Zamosis, joining some Protestants and Calvinists who were maybe already living there.
And the sources even list some of their names and jobs. That gives a real flavor.
It does. It's a pretty diverse list. You've got a chimney sweep, bricklayers, a tailor, weavers, carpenters, a nail maker, locksmith, tanners, wheelwright, miller, sausage makers, rope makers, stonemason, gunsmith. Quite a range of skills. And the names are fascinating, too. Many are clearly German, like Joseph Anker, the chimney sweep, or Gord Beyer, the tailor. But then you see names like Antoni Kozowski, listed as a watchmaker, and Jakub Matkowski, a baker. Those sound Polish. It kind of hints that maybe there was already some mixing, or perhaps some settlers already had Polish connections, even among these urban craftsmen.
That 1941 source you mentioned, the Listy Kolonisto, or colonist letters, sounds incredibly detailed for tracking families back.
It really is. Now, obviously, it was compiled during the Nazi occupation, so you have to consider the context. But as a genealogical resource, it's remarkable. It gives incredibly specific details, the exact town or village in Germany where a family came from, and then lists the villages in Zamoczyzna where their descendants were living in 1941. It lets you trace these family lines right across something like 160 years.
Could you give us another couple of examples from that source, just to see the pattern?
Sure. Let's see. The Albinger family, they came from a place called Epstein in the Saarpfalz region, and their descendants in 1941 were in Białoży, Przegi, Sitaniek, Brody. The Altmaier family from Puttlingen, also Saarpfalz, they first settled in Sitaniek back in 1786. By 1941, their descendants were in Huska, Sitaniek, Puski. Or the Bender family from Kirchenbollenbach, they started in Rojaniec in 1786. But by 1941, their descendants were spread quite widely across the region. And you also see how names changed, adapted over time. Like the Deckendorf family from Weisenheim, they settled in Meissen. Their name became Polonized over time at Tuckendorf. The Springer family often became Springer, found in places like Satanic, that Tedish or Dedish family we talked about from the passport. Their name became Tekic. They were in Sabaudia in 1941. Tindorfer became Tindorf, with descendants in Huska and Horizau.
It really drives home how these families became part of the local landscape over generations, doesn't it? Even as their name sometimes shifted a bit. But you mentioned earlier that, despite being there for centuries, this community eventually lost its German language. How did that happen?
Well, it seems largely due to being surrounded by Polish neighbors for such a long time, especially after 1809, when the region stopped being part of Austria and became part of the Duchy of Warsaw, then later Congress Poland under Russia. The political connection to German-speaking administration was cut. The sources indicate that by the mid-19th century, so maybe two or three generations after arrival, the descendants had largely stopped speaking German in daily life and adopted Polish instead. There's a really interesting anecdote in a source from 1942, written by an artist visiting Satanic during the occupation. He met a 70-year-old man named Mitya Springer, likely a descendant of those original Springers. And the artist noted that this man spoke German not always understandable, which suggests maybe a few very elderly people, perhaps in isolated pockets, still retain fragments of a very old dialect. But for the vast majority, German as a living language was gone.
But, and this seems key, despite losing the language, did they still hold on to some sense of being distinct?
Yeah.
A separate identity?
Yes, and that's one of the most striking things the sources highlight. Even though they spoke Polish, lived among Poles, adopted Polish customs, right up until World War II, the descendants of these German colonists tended to marry primarily within their own community, marrying other descendants of the original German settlers. This strong pattern of endogamy, marrying within the group, strongly suggests that a distinct group identity persisted even without the German language as a unifier.
So they were Polish-speaking, living in these villages for generations, but they still saw themselves, and maybe were seen by their Polish neighbors, as somehow different, perhaps based on their surnames, their family histories.
Exactly. Those surnames, even the slightly Polonized ones like Tuckendorf or Tetik, often remained clear markers of their origin. That 1941 colonist in brief list confirms that you see lots of families still carrying recognizably German names in 1941. Bender, Berlin, Grossman, Paul, Petz, Presch, Springer, Tetik, Thor, Tindorf, Wayland, Vels. These names acted as constant reminders of their distinct historical roots.
Okay, so let's fast forward. We have this community, linguistically Polish, but maintaining this distinct identity through names, marriage patterns, for centuries. And then World War II hits. And suddenly, this almost forgotten history becomes critically horribly important.
This is where the story takes that incredibly dark turn. In the winter of 1939, early 1940, the Nazi regime launched its big Heim ins Reich, home into the Reich action. This was about forcibly moving ethnic Germans from various parts of Eastern Europe back into Germany or into newly conquered territories like occupied Poland. But crucially, the Zamość colonists, this specific group, were not included in that initial wave of resettlement. They were somehow overlooked or maybe just not known about initially by the planners.
But the Nazis eventually did discover them.
Yes. Sometime after that first big resettlement push, the Nazi authorities realized or discovered that there was this quite large, identifiable community of people living in Zamościzna who had German surnames, a documented history of German ancestry, and who hadn't been moved in 1939-40.
And this discovery then became a justification for the Nazis' brutal plans for the whole Zamościk region.
Precisely. Their very existence was seized upon by the Nazi planners and ideologues. It became a major pretext for the planned Germanization of Zamościzna. The Nazis basically said, look, there are already Germans here. This land should be German. And they used the presence of these descendants to help justify the horrific ethnic cleansing, the mass expulsion of the Polish population from their homes and villages to make way for new ethnic German settlers brought in from places like Bessarabia and Romania.
So they weaponized this group's history.
Totally weaponized it. And they didn't just use them as a pretext. They actively intervened with the existing colonists, too. During the occupation, these descendants were targeted for intensive re-Germanization efforts. They brought in members of the German Girls Youth League, the BDM, these Einsatzmädel, under SS supervision, specifically to teach them German language and German customs.
Trying to force them back into a German identity that, for most, had faded generations ago.
Exactly. And the colonists themselves were put in this awful position, they were under constant pressure to prove their German origins to the occupation authorities. They were issued these temporary certificates of German origin. The sources call them Bierschikenkarte, white identity cards. These cards marked them as being of German background, but they also implicitly signaled that their Germanness was provisional, needing constant validation by the regime. It was an incredibly difficult, tragic situation for them, caught between the Polish life they knew and the regime's attempt to forcibly redefine them and use them for its own horrific purposes.
It's just a chilling, powerful example of how these long-distant historical events and identities, even ones that seem lost or faded, can be dug up and exploited with absolutely devastating results.
It really is a very stark reminder.
So we've really traced an incredible arc here from all these different parts of 18th century Germany, answering the call of Emperor Joseph II, moving to Austria and Galicia. We've seen how they were settled, the different kinds of support they got, the immense challenges they faced just getting there and setting up, and how they built these communities in Zamojizna that adapted, persisted for centuries, even losing their original language along the way.
And then that completely astonishing, tragic twist. Yeah. How this long, complex history, which seemed to have just blended into the background with linguistic and cultural assimilation, how it was suddenly violently pulled back into the spotlight centuries later during World War II and became twisted into a justification and a tool for Nazi atrocities in that very same region.
When you step back, what does a story like this tell us? I mean, it says so much about migration, doesn't it? About how people adapt, make new homes, about the really complex ways identity works, how it can hang on, even when obvious markers like language disappear. And just how historical events, no matter how far back, can cast these incredibly long, unpredictable shadows.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? About how the lives of ordinary people, entire communities, can be fundamentally shaped by decrees made by rulers hundreds of miles away, centuries before. How identity isn't some fixed thing, but it shifts and evolves over generations, often shaped most powerfully by your immediate neighbors and circumstances. And then how drastically things can change when some external power decides to step in later and impose its own definition of your identity, using it for its own agenda.
It really leaves you pondering that powerful question. What does it actually mean for a group to lose its language, maybe its most visible cultural badge, and yet somehow still be seen or maybe even see itself as distinct generations, centuries later, and for that very distinction, that rediscovered history, to ultimately lead them into such a tragic and dangerous position? Something to really think about.